January 24th, 1987, Martinez, California. 9-year-old Eric Coy leaves his home on his bicycle in order to visit his aunt's residence. 15 minutes later, Eric's body and bicycle are discovered in a nearby wooded area, and he has been stabbed several times. 4 weeks after Eric is killed, 6-year-old Jeremy Stoner goes missing from nearby Vallejo before he is also found murdered. And even though a suspect named Sean Melton is charged with the crime, both of his trials end in hung juries. While investigators explore potential connections between the two cases, they are unable to find conclusive answers, so the murders of Eric and Jeremy are never officially solved. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be exploring two cases involving murdered boys which took place within 4 weeks of each other in the same region of California. The 1987 murders of 9-year-old Eric Coy and 6-year-old Jeremy Stoner. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Hope Grimsley, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Hope. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for 5.5 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. The murder of Eric Coy is the case that Hope requested I cover when she originally entered this contest, and even though it was featured on an episode of the Case File podcast several years ago, I have to confess that I wasn't all that familiar with the story until Hope brought it to my attention. Eric Coy's murder is one of the more perplexing cold cases I've ever seen involving a child because it took place during a very narrow window of time. Within 15 minutes of leaving his house in order to ride his bicycle to his aunt's residence, Eric was found stabbed to death in a nearby wooded area, and even though investigators explored a number of different scenarios, there was no conclusive evidence to implicate any suspects, and no one could figure out the motive for such a senseless crime. Just 4 weeks after Eric's murder, our second victim on this episode, 6-year-old Jeremy Stoner, went missing from his neighborhood in another town located 12 miles away, and his body would be found in a remote area. Not surprisingly, investigators looked into possible connections between the two crimes, and it wasn't long before a suspect named Sean Melton was charged with Jeremy's murder. However, since the evidence against Melton was not particularly strong, both of his trials ended in hung juries and the charges were dropped. To this day, we still don't know for certain if Melton was guilty or if the same individual may have been responsible for killing Eric and Jeremy. Regardless, both of these boys deserve justice, so we're going to explore each of their cases on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved murders of Eric Coy and Jeremy Stoner. Our story begins in 1987 in Martinez, California, a town which is located in Contra Costa County in the East Bay region of the San Francisco Bay Area and had a population of around 24,000 at that time. Our first victim is 9-year-old Eric Coy, a third grade student at Las Juntas Elementary School who lives on Warren Street with his parents, Dan and Barbara Coy, and older brother, Jason. Shortly before 11 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, January the 24th, Eric asked his father if he could go out on his BMX bicycle and ride to his Aunt Angela's house. The residence was located a few blocks away, and Eric often went there to play with his cousin Edric, so Dan gave his son permission to go and told Eric to phone him once he arrived. Eric then rode away from his house, but he never made it to his aunt's residence, and within the next 15 minutes, he would turn up dead. At 11:15, a 13-year-old boy was cutting through the woods behind the west end of Martinez Junior High School when he noticed Eric's body and his bicycle lying near a footbridge which crossed over Alhambra Creek. The boy initially assumed that Eric may have gotten into a bike accident, so he ran to a nearby Boys and Girls Club to get help. Some teenagers were brought back into the woods, but they now noticed that Eric was covered in blood and had still not moved. One of the teenagers went to a nearby house to call for help, but by the time paramedics and officers from the Martinez Police Department arrived, Eric was pronounced dead at the scene. It turned out that he had been stabbed at least 10 times along his torso and once in the neck. The murder weapon was likely a knife or another sharp object which was about 6 or 7 inches long, but it was never found. By this point, Dan and Barbara Coy were concerned because Eric had not yet phoned them to confirm he arrived at his aunt's house, and when they called her, she told them that Eric never showed up. Dan and Barbara started searching the neighborhood for their son, but it wasn't long before they came across the murder scene and were informed by police that Eric had been murdered, which caused Barbara to become hysterical. The spot where Eric was killed was only 2 blocks from his home, and he played in that wooded area on weekends and used it as a shortcut to ride his bike to his aunt's residence. The area was considered to be safe, particularly since it was only a few blocks away from the Martinez police station, but one local resident who lived nearby said that he often noticed transients hanging out in the woods. The murder scene was also fairly close to a county mental hospital, so investigators looked into the possibility that one of the patients from there could have left the premises and harmed Eric, but they found nothing to suggest this had occurred. 2 days after the crime, police released a composite sketch of an unidentified man who had been seen in the area at around 9 a.m. on the morning Eric was murdered. He was described as being a light-skinned Latino or Italian male who was between 18 to 21 years old, 5 feet 8 inches tall, and weighed around 165 pounds. He had black-combed medium-length hair and a few acne scars or pockmarks on his face. The man also wore a Levi jacket, Levi faded pants, and light-colored tennis shoes, and was seen carrying a short, collapsible-type umbrella. Of course, no one could be certain if this was the individual who killed Eric, so police did not call him a suspect, but they at least wanted to question him as a potential witness. It was also reported that a compact red pickup truck, possibly a Datsun or Toyota, had been seen in the area around the time of the murder. The crime left the entire community horrified and perplexed, as Eric was the first child to ever be murdered in the history of Martinez. The town had only experienced one murder the previous year, but believe it or not, only 4 hours after Eric was killed, another stabbing death would occur in Martinez. At around 3:30 p.m., 25-year-old Alan Lee Tilley was found stabbed and bleeding inside a gutter outside his home, only about a mile and a half from where Eric was killed. Even though Tilley was rushed to a hospital, he died just under 4 hours later and never got the opportunity to identify his killer. Naturally, there was initial speculation that the two crimes might be connected, but it wasn't long before a suspect named Mark Cornelius was charged with Tilly's murder. Cornelius and his two brothers had attacked Tilley because he had been seeing Cornelius' girlfriend, so the murder was unrelated to Eric's case, and it was just a coincidence that both crimes took place on the same date. Eric was known for being friendly and outgoing, and he had received a good citizenship award at his school the week before he was killed. His parents also described him as being a streetwise kid who knew not to talk to strangers, so if he had come across someone he didn't know in the woods, They did not believe he would have stopped or climbed off his bike in order to speak with them. However, one person who was looked at as a potential suspect was Benjamin Gomez, whose sister Alicia was next-door neighbors with the Coy family. The Coys and Alicia lived in a duplex and shared a driveway, but on January the 23rd, the night before Eric was killed, Alicia complained that Eric had been leaving his bicycle in the driveway and blocking the path to their front door. Benjamin Gomez just happened to be visiting his sister that night, and he got into a heated argument with Barbara Coy. At the time, Dan was out visiting a friend, but Barbara was so intimidated by Benjamin that she called her husband and asked him to come home. When Dan returned, he got into a confrontation with Benjamin and would later tell police that Benjamin threatened to kill Eric if he ever left his bike in the driveway again. This prompted Dan to call the police, who showed up at the scene in order to quell the situation, but since Eric was murdered the very next morning, Benjamin came under suspicion. Following Eric's death, Benjamin voluntarily went to the police station to be questioned, and he maintained that the Coys greatly exaggerated their story. He denied making any direct threats towards Eric or having any involvement in his murder, and investigators found no evidence to suggest he committed the crime. However, when Eric's parents looked at the composite sketch of the unidentified man who had been seen in the area on the morning of Eric's murder, they seemed certain they had seen this man before and wondered if he might have been a friend of Benjamin's. Investigators soon noticed that the sketch seemed to bear a resemblance to a sketch which had been created for a suspect in a home invasion robbery which took place in the town of Atherton, located over 60 miles south of Martinez. The crime occurred on January the 30th, just 6 days after Eric's murder took place, as 16-year-old Luke Colura Jr. and his 17-year-old girlfriend Gina Moore broke into Gina's residence and proceeded to tie up and rob her parents, Howard and Barbara Moore, at gunpoint. The couple stole $3,500 worth of jewelry before fleeing the state in the Moore's car and wound up going on a crime spree and committing a number of armed robberies in Nevada until they were apprehended 48 hours later. After the Moores provided a description of Colura, a composite sketch was created for him, and since it resembled the sketch of the man from Martinez, Colura was questioned about his potential involvement in Eric's murder. But once again, this lead went nowhere, and no evidence was found to suggest that Colura was responsible. So now we're going to take a brief detour away from Eric's case to talk about another shocking murder of a young boy, which took place only 4 weeks later. The crime occurred in the nearby city of Vallejo, located in Solano County, just over 12 miles southwest of Martinez, and the victim was 6-year-old Jeremy Stoner, who was just 2 weeks shy of his 7th birthday. Jeremy lived on Westwood Avenue with his parents, John and Karen Stoner, as well as his two older brothers, and on Saturday, February the 21st, while their parents were working, the three boys were being babysat by their aunt, Violet. However, Violet's own 7-year-old daughter came down with appendicitis, so she was forced to leave the boys alone in order to rush her to the emergency room and ask one of the neighbors to check on them from time to time while she was gone. A birthday party was being held at this neighbor's residence that afternoon, and at 3:30 p.m., Jeremy attempted to go there for a visit, but was told he was not invited inside because it was an all-girls party. This prompted Jeremy to open a packet of ketchup he was carrying and spill it on the porch, and when he refused to clean it up, the neighbor scolded him. By the time Karen Stoner returned home at 4 o'clock, Jeremy was no longer there, and it was theorized that the incident with the ketchup may have prompted him to run away for fear that he was going to get into trouble with his parents. But when a search of the neighborhood failed to find Jeremy, he was reported missing to the Vallejo Police Department. A bloodhound would track Jeremy's scent to an abandoned house located nearly 2 miles away from his residence. This location was often used as a clubhouse by the local kids, and Jeremy had been there before, but his scent came to an end. 4 days later, on February the 25th, a group of motorists were attempting to free a car which had gotten stuck in some mud on Sherman Island Road in the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta in Sacramento County. The location was about 30 miles away from Vallejo, and while searching beneath some weeds to find something to help free the vehicle, the motorist came across Jeremy's nude body. It was soon announced that he had been strangled to death, and his clothing was never found. Once Jeremy's murder made the news, an eyewitness came forward and reported having seen a white or pastel-colored Ford station wagon in that area the day before Jeremy's body was found. According to the witness, a white male in his late 20s, who may have had auburn hair and mutton chop sideburns, pulled a large plastic garbage bag out of the car, took it towards the Sacramento River, and when the man returned to his vehicle, the bag was now empty. Police were planning to release composite sketches of the man and the station wagon to the public, but decided to hold off on doing so because they believed there were some missing elements to the witness's story. However, this lead soon wound up being cast aside when another promising suspect popped up on the radar. On March the 3rd, 26-year-old Sean Quincy Melton walked into the Vallejo police station and told them that he had important information about Jeremy's murder. Melton was a 26-year-old freelance security guard who was unemployed at that point, and he and his wife, Laura Melton, lived in a trailer park owned by Laura's parents, which was located only a mile away from Jeremy's residence. What Melton did not realize is that 20 minutes before he walked into the police station, they had received an anonymous tip from a woman who implicated him in Jeremy's murder. It would later turn out that the tipster was a psychologist that Melton had been seeing during the early 1980s, after he was ordered to undergo psychiatric treatment for threatening his parents. Melton had spent time in and out of psychiatric hospitals since he was a child, and he had allegedly once told this psychologist that he fantasized about taking young boys to the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta area and doing harm to them. When the psychologist learned about Jeremy's murder, she felt compelled to share this information with the police, so Melton was already on the radar as a potential suspect by the time he arrived at the station. Melton said that he was a private detective representing the Stoner family and offered up a 15-page typewritten investigative report he had put together about Jeremy's murder. He was known for having a devout interest in true crime and cold cases, and even though he was not affiliated with law enforcement, he would often tell his neighbors stories about how he was working with the police and the FBI. 2 months earlier, Melton had approached the Vallejo PD and asked if he could see their files on the Zodiac Killer because he felt he could help solve the case. On the day after Jeremy went missing, Melton claimed that he had been visiting the site of one of the Zodiac murders when he saw a boy whom he believed was Jeremy in the distance. After learning that the boy was missing and soon turned up murdered, he said he felt compelled to assist with the investigation and even went so far as to visit the Stoner residence, informing Jeremy's parents that he had his own detective agency and wanted to offer his assistance. Melton also participated in the search effort and attended Jeremy's funeral, as well as a candlelight vigil for him. Believe it or not, Melton's so-called investigative report listed Jeremy's father, John Stoner, as his prime suspect because he felt that John seemed too calm and unemotional at his son's candlelight vigil. Even though Melton tried to paint himself as an investigator, those who knew him believed he was living in a fantasy world, as Melton had a drinking problem and an explosive temper, which led to him often quarreling with his wife and hitting her on a few occasions. While Melton did have a criminal record, it was for misdemeanor offenses, such as petty theft and passing bad checks. After Melton arrived at the police station to present his report, investigators asked him to return later that day, and after he complied, Melton would be extensively interrogated about Jeremy's murder for around 30 hours. The police were hoping that Melton would make a full confession, but even though he never did, they ultimately decided to charge him with murder, kidnapping, and molestation. According to investigators, while Melton did pass a polygraph, he still implicated himself by revealing information about the crime which only the perpetrator could have known. At one point, Melton presented a hypothetical scenario in which the killer took Jeremy camping in the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta before he proceeded to sodomize the boy, stab him in the neck, strangle him with a coat hanger wrapped in a shirt, and dump Jeremy's clothing in the river. At the time Melton was interrogated, the details about Jeremy being stabbed and sodomized had not been released publicly. However, shortly after he was charged with the crime, Melton told the press, quote, "I didn't do it. I gave information to them, and they used it against me," end quote. Melton did not have an attorney during his interrogation session, and even though he never actually confessed to Jeremy's murder, he said he feared he would never be allowed to leave the room unless he did. Melton was assigned a public defender named Peter Four, who immediately questioned the police's tactics during the interrogation. Even though Melton was never officially diagnosed, the detectives who questioned him believed that he was suffering from multiple personality disorder. They said that he appeared to change voices and displayed at least three different personalities during the interrogation session. At one point, Melton said that he had another personality named Wolfen, who had participated in Jeremy's kidnapping but did not actually murder him, and he referred to the person who did kill Jeremy as the Terminator. This prompted Lieutenant Al Lehman to say to Melton, quote, "Bring the mean one out. We don't want to talk to Sean anymore. Let the mean one convince us himself that Sean didn't do it. The mean one committed murder on a 6-year-old child, so Sean Melton is going to jail. Now let us talk to the mean one so we can all go home tonight." End quote. Sean's wife, Laura, would later acknowledge that her husband sometimes displayed an alternate personality named John Wolfe, who acted mean towards her and forced her to perform bizarre sexual acts. When police performed a search of Melton's mobile home, they found a 5-page autobiographical document he had written in October of 1985, in which he discussed his mental health issues and shared a fantasy in which he was the leader of a group called the Wolfen Gang and would rape children and kill anyone who prevented him from carrying this out. The search also turned up what detectives described as quote-unquote cryptic clippings on Melton's coffee table, one of which contained the name Jeremy. They believed that Melton had been planning to use these clippings to put together an anonymous message and send it to the police. In spite of this, Melton continued to maintain his innocence and entered a not guilty plea to Jeremy's murder. Not surprisingly, the Martinez Police Department believed that Melton might be a potential suspect in Eric Coy's murder. Investigators from Martinez questioned Melton about the crime and performed their own search of his mobile home, but no evidence could be found to implicate Melton, and there was nothing to conclusively prove that Eric and Jeremy's murders were connected. One issue that Melton's public defender, Peter Four, had with his client's interrogation session is that the police had gone to the trouble of creating a composite sketch of Melton's face. They then proceeded to show Melton the sketch and told him it had been provided by a witness who saw him near the murder scene. Of course, this was completely false, and the tactic did not scare Melton into making a confession. As you recall, right before Melton was charged with the crime, a witness had reported seeing another man in a station wagon near the murder scene, and while a composite sketch was created for this man, it was never released publicly. While Four wanted to see the sketch, he was frustrated to learn that the police had destroyed it once Melton became the prime suspect. Due to the expensive publicity surrounding the case, Four filed a successful motion for a change of venue, so the trial was moved from Solano County to Sacramento Superior Court and began in late May of 1988. The prosecution's case against Melton would be very circumstantial, as no physical evidence linked him to the crime. They presented videotapes of Melton's interrogation session and continued to allege that he shared details about the murder that only the perpetrator could have known. At one point, the police videotaped themselves bringing Melton to Sherman Island Road, where he supposedly picked out the spot where Jeremy's body had been found. While the state presented this as evidence that Melton had inside knowledge of the crime, Melton claimed that he had only made a calculated guess because police were threatening to take his wife into custody if he did not cooperate. One of the prosecution's key witnesses was Joyce Shires, an employee from a campus bookstore at Napa Valley College, where Melton had been taking criminal justice courses. According to Shires, during the 4-day window between when Jeremy went missing and his body was found, Melton had come into the bookstore and told her that he was assisting police with the case and told them that he traced the child to the Sacramento area. A few days later, after Jeremy was discovered in the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta, Melton returned to the store and told Shires that Jeremy was strangled by someone using a cloth with a wire in it, even though the media had only reported that the boy had been strangled without providing any specific details. For their part, the defense tried to poke holes in the state's claim that Melton had knowledge of the crime, which only the perpetrator could have known. Even though Melton had presented a scenario where Jeremy was strangled with a coat hanger wrapped in his shirt, the defense called upon a pathologist who testified that he believed the murder weapon was actually a bungee cord with hooks on the ends. The same pathologist also attempted to discredit the notion that Melton had inside knowledge of the crime when he speculated that Jeremy had been sodomized. In actuality, the autopsy did not conclusively prove that any sexual assault had taken place, and while there were discolorations on Jeremy's body, the pathologist believed they were caused by decomposition. The prosecution called upon some witnesses to testify that they had seen Jeremy inside Melton's pickup truck before he was murdered. A male and female employee from a bait shop in Fairfield claimed that on February the 22nd or 23rd, a day or two after Jeremy went missing, Melton came inside their shop to purchase a six-pack of beer. The female employee noticed a boy in his pickup truck parked outside, and since Jeremy's disappearance had already made the news by this point, and she felt the boy might be him, she said she asked Melton for his driver's license when he purchased the beer. She then proceeded to write down his name before Melton left the shop and drove away. Following Melton's arrest, the male and female employee both picked him out of a photo lineup, with the male saying that he was 99% certain Melton was the man from the bait shop, and the female saying she was 80% certain. Additional testimony was provided by a neighbor of Jeremy's named Lisa Novak, who claimed that she and a female friend had seen Jeremy inside a black pickup truck sometime on the afternoon he went missing. Novak said that Melton was driving, and Jeremy may have had his hands bound, but even though she asked her friend to chase after the truck, they wound up losing it in heavy traffic. However, the defense tried to discredit Novak's testimony, as they did not believe she would have been able to see a captive boy inside the truck from her vantage point. Novak also did not immediately report this alleged abduction to the police and stayed silent about it for weeks. But she said this was because she was scared and her fiancé had advised her not to get involved. The last confirmed sighting of Jeremy on the day he disappeared was when he was seen at his neighbor's house at 3:30 p.m., but Melton claimed that he had an alibi for this time period, as he and his wife had gone to a theater to see a screening of the movie Mannequin. Laura Melton backed up her husband's alibi, and another witness testified that they had seen Melton at the theater that afternoon. The trial also featured testimony from a jailhouse informant named Timothy McCapes, a convicted forager who had been in adjoining cells with Melton while he was awaiting trial. McCapes claimed that Melton told him he had lured Jeremy into his truck by offering him a $1 bill and attempted to sexually assault the boy, but wound up stabbing him in the neck with a pair of scissors and strangling him with a wire when he tried to get away. Melton then supposedly broke down crying and said that everybody should be happy because Jeremy was now in heaven. While Melton denied this confession ever took place, and the defense argued that McCapes was providing this false testimony in order to avoid extradition to Pennsylvania, where he was facing additional charges. While the case eventually went to the jury, who would deliberate for a total of 6.5 days, but on June the 28th, they announced they were hopelessly deadlocked on the murder, kidnapping, and molestation charges. The jurors' vote was 7-5 in favor of acquittal, so a mistrial wound up being declared. Melton would go on trial for the second time in August of that year, and the cases presented by the defense and the prosecution would pretty much be the same. However, the key difference this time around is that the state introduced new testimony from a second jailhouse informant, a trans woman named Amanda Fairguy, formerly known as David Bentley. Before she transitioned, Fairguy had been housed in jail alongside Melton and claimed that she heard him make incriminating statements about Jeremy's murder, as he said that, quote-unquote, someone inside him killed the boy. Fairguy was now serving a life sentence on first-degree murder and robbery charges, so Peter Ford tried to discredit her testimony, though he generated some controversy by dead-naming Fairguy and constantly referring to her as Mr. Bentley while questioning her on the witness stand. Regardless, Fairguy's new testimony did not bring the state any closer to a conviction. The case went to the jury a second time, but on October the 3rd, after deliberating for a week, they announced that they were hopelessly deadlocked on the murder and kidnapping charges. This time, the vote was 9-3 in favor of acquittal, but since the jury did not believe it was conclusively proven that Jeremy had been sexually assaulted, they managed to reach a unanimous verdict on the molestation charge and found Melton not guilty. Once again, a mistrial was declared, so a hearing was held in Solano County Superior Court to determine if Melton would be tried on the murder and kidnapping charges for the third time. On October the 24th, a Superior Court judge ruled that he did not believe there was enough evidence to bring Melton to trial again, so the charges against him were dropped. After being incarcerated for 19 months, Melton was finally released from jail, but the state announced that if additional evidence against Melton were to surface, they still had the option to rearrest him and take him to trial again. Following his release, Melton held a press conference in which he stated that he and his wife were planning to leave the Vallejo area to start over. He expressed his sympathies towards the Stoner family and hoped that the authorities would find Jeremy's real killer. In May of 1989, Melton did an interview in which he revealed that he and his wife had moved away and were now living in an undisclosed location in the continental United States. He was working a new job handling consumer complaints for an entertainment company and had sworn off doing any more investigations into unsolved cold cases. There do not seem to be any details available about Melton's life over the next decade, but on June the 14th, 2000, he passed away at the age of 38. No one else has ever been charged with Jeremy Stoner's murder, and it seems like the investigation ground to a dead halt following Melton's second mistrial. As for Eric Coy's murder, no conclusive evidence was ever found to indicate that Melton was involved in that crime or that it had any connection to Jeremy's murder. Eric's case also just seemed to disappear from the spotlight for several years, though in January of 2016, the Martinez Tribune published a new article about the murder containing comments from Sergeant Dave Mathers, the new lead detective for the Martinez PD. While Mathers never specifically mentioned DNA, he confirmed that biological evidence existed, which he believed was worth an additional look. But unfortunately, there haven't been any new developments in the case since then, so after 36 years, the murders of Eric Coy and Jeremy Stoner both continue to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. Anyway, when I started working on this episode, I had originally only intended to cover the murder of Eric Coy, as the murder of Jeremy Stoner would only get a passing reference in most of the sources about Eric's case. But when I started digging deeper into Jeremy's murder, I thought it was a pretty intriguing case in its own right, which was worthy of discussion, and since it never ended with a conviction, it's technically never been solved. I'll state right up front that regardless of whether Sean Melton is guilty or innocent of the murder of Jeremy Stoner, I have my doubts that he was responsible for killing Eric Coy. In fact, since the circumstances of how each of these crimes were carried out are so different, I am inclined to believe that Eric and Jeremy were not killed by the same individual. But I can understand why the authorities might have felt the murders were connected, as they took place within 4 weeks of each other in towns that were only 12 miles apart. The key difference between the crimes is that Eric seemed to be ambushed and killed during a narrow window of time, and there's nothing to indicate that the crime was sexually motivated. While it was never conclusively established if Jeremy was sexually assaulted, his body was found nude in a remote area 30 miles from his home, so he was clearly the victim of an abduction. However, I guess I can't completely rule out the possibility that Eric's killer attempted to abduct him, but wound up killing the boy in the woods when he put up resistance. If you believe both crimes were committed by the same perpetrator, perhaps they decided to abduct Jeremy 4 weeks later because they failed to do so with Eric the first time around. But regardless of whether or not there were multiple killers involved, the indisputable fact is that Eric and Jeremy's deaths were both senseless and horrific crimes, which left a devastating effect on their families and communities. Jeremy's case seemed to completely fade from the spotlight after Sean Melton's second trial ended in a hung jury, and I have not seen any media coverage of it for 3 decades. I get the impression that since the authorities were certain that Melton was the killer, they did not spend much time investigating alternate suspects, and only planned to take the case to court again if additional evidence surfaced against Melton. Aside from the aforementioned case file episode in January of 2018, I have not seen much coverage of Eric's case either these past few decades. I was saddened to learn on the case file episode that Eric's father, Dan Coy, seemed to go on a complete downward spiral following his son's death. After his marriage ended in divorce, Dan struggled with drug and alcohol addiction and was living in his car by the mid-1990s. He apparently told his other son, Jason, that he quote-unquote took care of the individual who killed Eric, though this was never conclusively established. There was one incident where Dan fired a gun at a moving vehicle containing two strangers who denied any knowledge of Eric's case and claimed to have no idea why Dan shot at them. Dan served some time in prison for this offense, but he wound up taking his own life shortly after his release. So I guess we'll start off by exploring Eric's case, which remains one of the most perplexing crimes involving a murdered child I've ever seen. It's a very difficult case to analyze because there were very few promising leads, and the nature of the crime just seems so random. What would prompt someone to fatally stab a 9-year-old boy several times? When adults murder children, their primary motive is often sexual assault, but I see no indication that's the case here. Even though I push forward the possibility that this was a failed abduction gone wrong, the location where the murder took place seems to go against that. This was in a wooded area behind a school and next to a footbridge which crossed over a river, so I don't get the impression it was that close to any roads. Even if the perpetrator had a vehicle parked nearby, it would have been difficult for them to carry Eric through the woods towards it. It was apparently an ordinary routine for Eric to take this route as a shortcut whenever he rode his bicycle to his aunt's house, and there was a window of only about 15 minutes between when Eric left his home and his body was found. If this was a premeditated murder, perhaps the perpetrator was lying in wait for Eric because they knew he would be riding through those woods eventually and it would be easy to kill him without anyone seeing anything. But on the other hand, transients apparently like to hang out in this area, so maybe Eric was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time and crossed paths with a stranger who, for reasons unknown, decided to stab him several times. I think my biggest issue with the idea of this being a premeditated crime is that even if someone had a personal grudge against Eric, how would they have known he would be passing through those woods on that particular morning at that particular time? While the killer may have been familiar with Eric's route, he had only asked his father if he could go to his aunt's place a few minutes before he left. Yes, Eric liked to go there a lot, and since this crime took place on a Saturday, I guess it would not have been unreasonable to assume he might go there again, but it doesn't make much sense for the killer to lie in wait like that, since for all they knew, Eric could have had alternate plans that day. As far as I can tell, the only people who had advance knowledge that Eric would visit his aunt's that morning were his own family. The one person who popped up on the radar as a potential suspect with a motive to harm Eric was Benjamin Gomez, the brother of the Coy family's next-door neighbor. The previous evening, he had a heated exchange with Dan Coy over Eric leaving his bicycle in his sister's driveway and supposedly told Dan that if Eric ever did this again, he would kill him. Benjamin always insisted that this conversation was blown way out of proportion and that the timing of Eric being murdered the very next morning was nothing more than a tragic coincidence. Indeed, while people have been murdered for very stupid reasons, it's hard to reconcile a grown adult stabbing a 9-year-old boy nearly a dozen times because of how he parked his bicycle. Those type of murders are usually heat-of-the-moment type crimes committed by people in a violent rage, but no matter how angry Benjamin might have been about the situation, I'd like to think he would have cooled down by the following morning. Even if the allegations are true, and Benjamin really made those threatening comments, he specifically said he would kill Eric if he left his bike in the driveway again, but there's no indication that Eric went on to do anything else which might have angered Benjamin. Another complication is that Benjamin did not even live next door to the Coys and had only been visiting his sister on that particular night, so I'm not even sure if he could be placed in the area on the morning of the crime. If you believe Benjamin was the killer, then that would mean he was either lying in wait in the woods for Eric to pass through, where he happened to see Eric leaving his house on his bicycle and decided to follow him to that spot. It sounds like the police were inclined to believe that Benjamin was not involved, and I do not believe they have any suspicions about his sister Alicia either. However, when Eric's parents saw the composite sketch of the unidentified man who had been seen in the area that morning, they thought he seemed familiar and wondered if it might have been a friend of Benjamin's. So were they implying that they believed Benjamin hired someone to kill their son? Anything's possible, I guess, but it seems like an awful lot of trouble to orchestrate a murder-for-hire plot on a kid for parking his bike in a driveway. Another issue with the composite sketch is that we can't even be certain that this man was responsible for Eric's murder, as he was supposedly spotted in the area at 9 a.m., which is about 2 hours before the crime took place. For all we know, he could have been a completely innocent bystander, so I definitely wouldn't implicate or clear anyone based on the resemblance to the sketch. While we're on the subject, investigators briefly looked into 16-year-old Luke Kalura Jr. as a potential suspect, because he apparently bore a resemblance to the sketch, but I really don't see anything to point to his involvement. He lived over 60 miles away in Atherton, and while he and his girlfriend went on a 2-day crime spree, which involved robbing multiple people, they never actually killed anyone. So what would compel Kalura to travel all the way to Martinez and senselessly murder a 9-year-old boy who's probably not going to be carrying a lot of valuables? I think that angle is a dead end, and I guess the only other specific person who was looked at as a suspect was Sean Melton after he was charged with the murder of Jeremy Stoner. Given all the local publicity surrounding that case, I'm sure that if investigators found anything to suggest Melton's potential involvement in Eric's murder, we would have heard about it, but it sounds like they came up completely empty. So where does this leave us? I suppose it's possible that Eric could have been stabbed to death by another kid, but he seemed to be well-liked and did not have any apparent enemies, so I'm guessing there weren't any other children from the area who stood out as having a motive to harm him. It's not clear if Eric was knocked off his bike or if he stopped and climbed off it before he was stabbed, but his parents described him as a streetwise kid who never would have stopped for a stranger. So if Eric got off the bike on his own, then this may mean he encountered someone he knew and trusted. But if the killer was a stranger, that person may have knocked Eric off his bike and attacked him in a violent rage. Given the amount of times Eric was stabbed, it's logical to assume that the killer would have gotten a lot of blood on themselves, yet it may just be blind luck that they managed to escape undetected, even though Eric's body was discovered a short time after the murder took place. Since this location was close to a county mental hospital, another theory that has been pushed forward is that the killer may have been a patient or former patient there, but I'm guessing that investigators probably looked into this possibility and never found any patients who stood out as suspects. But I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility that the killer was a transient, as they were known for hanging out in that particular wooded area. The murder could have been completely random, and the perpetrator decided to attack Eric simply because he just happened to ride through the woods. If that is what happened, then that only makes the crime all the more terrifying and a lot more difficult to solve. The last time this case made the news was in 2016, when Sergeant Dave Mathers mentioned that biological evidence existed, which he believed was worth a fresh look. He never confirmed what exactly this biological evidence was, but back in 1987, DNA profiling was not yet a major tool in criminal investigations. If the killer did leave behind their DNA, then the best chance investigators have to solve this case would be to enter this evidence into a genealogical database and hope for a match. Even if the perpetrator has already passed away, a DNA match would still establish beyond a shadow of a doubt that they were responsible for the crime. So now let's move on to discussing Jeremy Stoner's murder, which is also technically still unsolved, but in the most frustrating way possible. If Sean Melton had been found not guilty at either of his trials, it still would have been painful for Jeremy's family, but at least it would be a conclusion of some sort, as double jeopardy would prevent the state from bringing Melton to trial for the same crime again. However, we instead had two separate trials end in hung juries, which meant there was always the possibility that Melton could be brought to trial again if stronger evidence were to surface. So this meant that Jeremy's loved ones would still have to cling on to the hope that there might still be justice in this case, at least until Melton passed away in 2000. Hypothetically, if these trials had ended with 11 jurors voting guilty and one lone holdout juror voting not guilty, then it's possible that the state would have been allowed to take Melton to trial a third time with the evidence they already had. However, both juries were very divided with respect to 7-5 and 9-3 votes in favor of an acquittal, and they both had to deliberate for about a week. Following the second mistrial, Melton's public defender, Peter Foer, made a sarcastic comment about how if this pattern was any indication, he would only have to take his client to trial two more times before he finally got a unanimous not guilty verdict from 12 jurors. Indeed, the fact that both juries were leaning towards an acquittal is a strong indicator that the prosecution did not have a particularly strong case, and even if Melton was guilty, it had not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Melton was only 38 years old when he died, and while I don't have any details about the exact cause of death, I guess those who still believe he killed Jeremy can take comfort in knowing that karma eventually got him. However, if Melton was actually innocent, he never did get his name cleared and still had to live with the stigma of being an accused murderer who only avoided prison time because two juries failed to reach a verdict. I get the impression that the authorities never wavered from their belief that Melton was the right guy all along, and since he's now deceased and there's nothing else they can do, they probably have no motivation to keep investigating this case. But if they were wrong, that only means that Jeremy's real killer is still getting away with it. So I can think of numerous cases in which a suspect wound up being arrested for a crime because they seem to have an unhealthy obsession with it and raise some major red flags. Obviously, a prime example of this is the arrest and recent conviction of Steve Pankey for the 1984 abduction and murder of 12-year-old Janelle Matthews. While there was no physical evidence linking Pankey to the crime, he popped up on the radar as a suspect because he constantly inserted himself into the investigation and made a number of incriminating statements, even though he had no apparent connection to the victim. And pretty much the exact same thing happened with Sean Melton. While he lived only about a mile away from Jeremy Stoner's residence, he did not actually know the family, yet he was constantly making himself the center of attention and was brazen enough to offer his own investigative services to Jeremy's grieving parents, even though he had no experience as a law enforcement officer or a private investigator. I certainly don't want to judge a murder suspect based on their appearance, but if you go back and look at photographs of Melton from that time period, he's definitely a strange-looking dude, as he was only 5'1", but weighed 190 pounds, and was described as having a childlike demeanor. To be fair, it sounds like Melton was an amateur sleuth who had an obsession with unsolved cold cases in general and wanted to assist with them in order to make himself feel important. Before he involved himself in Jeremy's case, his pet project was trying to solve the Zodiac murders, so if that's all there was to it, I wouldn't be all that suspicious of him. However, Melton also wrote out and shared fantasies about sexually assaulting and killing young boys, and that's a lot more problematic. Regardless of his guilt or innocence, it seems pretty clear that Melton was a disturbed individual with a number of mental health issues, and even though he was never officially diagnosed, the state seemed to believe that Melton was suffering from multiple personality disorder, and one of his alternate personalities could have compelled him to murder Jeremy. The police thought that Melton was assuming these personalities during his lengthy interrogation session, such as when he started talking in a different voice for a persona he called Wolfen. Believe it or not, during a preliminary hearing to determine if Melton should stand trial, there was some debate about whether investigators should have read Wolfen his Miranda rights because they were technically questioning a separate personality about the crime. The Vallejo PD did face a lot of criticism for how they handled Melton's interrogation, and even some of the jurors who believed that Melton was guilty and voted to convict him openly expressed their issues with it. When I first read that Melton was interrogated for 30 hours without the presence of an attorney, I immediately rolled my eyes, because I've seen so many wrongful conviction cases which follow the same pattern, and end with the police coercing the defendant into making a false confession. So I was surprised to see that Melton never actually did confess, though investigators still thought he made enough incriminating statements that they still charged him with the murder anyway. Since the world did not have as much awareness about the issue of false confessions during the 1980s, I think there's a good chance that if Melton had confessed, a jury would have found that to be compelling enough evidence to convict him, regardless of how weak the rest of the case might have been. Now, it seems like the crux of the state's case against Melton is that he revealed details about the crime which only the killer could have known, but even that is debatable. For example, even though Melton told both the police and a bookstore employee that Jeremy had been strangled with a coat hanger wrapped in a shirt, this was never conclusively established, as the murder weapon was never found, and a pathologist testified that he believed a bungee cord may have been used for the strangulation. And while Melton said that Jeremy had been sodomized, the same pathologist said that it could not be conclusively determined if any sexual abuse took place. But on the other hand, Melton did say that Jeremy had been stabbed in the neck, a detail which turned out to be accurate. We also had some witnesses who believed they saw Jeremy inside Melton's pickup truck, but as you well know, eyewitness testimony can often be unreliable. While one of these witnesses knew Jeremy personally, she also said that she thought he was being abducted, and it's very odd that she would not report this for weeks, even though Jeremy's disappearance and murder was front page news throughout the area. And of course, the prosecution also presented what I always believed to be the ultimate sign of desperation in a weak case, and that's testimony from a jailhouse informant who claimed they overheard Melton confess to the murder. I'm not going to say with 100% certainty that all jailhouse informants are liars, but a good percentage of them are, because these are criminals who are not above fabricating stories in order to help their own legal situation. In this case, I find it particularly ridiculous that the state suddenly produced new testimony from another jailhouse informant at Melton's second trial. It's almost like the result of the previous trial shattered their confidence that they could get a conviction, so they were desperate for new evidence to spice things up. I think the biggest point in Melton's favor is that he supposedly had an alibi placing him inside a movie theater on the afternoon Jeremy went missing. Yes, one of the people who provided this alibi was Melton's own wife, Laura, so I can understand being skeptical, but there was another independent eyewitness who recalled seeing them at that screening. It sounds like the Meltons did not have the happiest marriage, as Sean was supposedly abusive towards Laura and did not treat her well, but she did stick by him throughout both trials and moved with him to another state, so I'm guessing that she did not believe her husband was a child murderer. But if Melton's alibi is solid, then you can discount all these allegations about him having inside knowledge of the crime and rule him out as a suspect. Look, I'm not going to say that I completely believe that Melton was innocent, as there were definitely a number of troubling things about him. And even if he did not hurt Jeremy, I'm still really bothered by his statements and writings about harming children, which make me wonder if he has committed other crimes like that. But I still feel that the evidence was not there to prove Melton's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, so I'm not surprised that neither of his trials ended in a conviction. I really think that when Melton refused to confess to the crime after 30 hours of interrogation, the police should have just let him go and started looking for additional evidence to build a stronger case, rather than charging him with murder at that point. However, I'm sure they were under a lot of pressure to solve this case, and figured they had received a big break by having this guy just fall into their laps, so they got it into their heads that he was Jeremy's killer. But unfortunately, they may have let the real killer slip through their fingers. So on the afternoon Jeremy went missing, it seems like after he got scolded for spilling ketchup on his neighbor's porch, he may have decided to run away because he feared he would get into trouble once his parents got home. A police bloodhound tracked Jeremy's scent to an abandoned house 2 miles away, so he very well could have gone there to hide out, as this place was often used as a clubhouse by the local kids. If Jeremy was in that area, then he easily could have been abducted and murdered, possibly by a complete stranger who had no connection to him. But were there any other promising suspects besides Sean Melton? Well, as you recall, shortly before Melton was charged with the crime, a witness reported having seen a white male in a light-colored station wagon dumping something out of a garbage bag in the area where Jeremy's body was found. The man was described as having mutton chops, which Melton definitely did not have, and Melton drove a pickup truck rather than a station wagon. And while a composite sketch was created for this guy, it was never released publicly, and conveniently went missing after Melton was arrested. Granted, just because this individual was seen in that area does not necessarily mean he was the killer, and it sounds like investigators had some issues with the witness's story, so perhaps his account has no relevance. But it would be a shame if the man in the station wagon was the real perpetrator and managed to get away with it. It's also worth mentioning that in a preliminary hearing prior to Melton's trial, Peter Four brought up a potential suspect named Thomas Boren, a 62-year-old former Vallejo Chamber of Commerce president. Boren had apparently attempted suicide a few days after Jeremy's body was discovered, and 5 months later, on June the 23rd, 1987, he was arrested on multiple charges of child molestation. Boren was accused of sexually abusing no less than 7 boys in both California and Nevada, and while he was released on bail, he would make another suicide attempt 10 days later, and this time, he took his own life with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. It sounds like Boren was on the police's list of potential suspects for Jeremy's murder before Melton was charged with the crime, but I have no idea how thoroughly he was investigated or if there was any evidence to implicate him. Unfortunately, I don't have any further information about Boren other than Four briefly mentioning him during that one hearing. It sounds like Boren was an habitual sex offender, so theoretically, I could see a scenario where he abducted Jeremy for the purposes of molesting him, but then things somehow escalated into murder. We have no idea why Boren made that first suicide attempt in early 1987, but if he didn't originally plan on killing Jeremy, perhaps the discovery of the boy's body sent him over the edge. However, Boren's potential involvement is nothing more than pure speculation, so for all we know, Jeremy may have fallen victim to a random predator who never even popped up on the radar as a suspect. Since Jeremy's body was nude and his clothing was never found, perhaps the perpetrator decided to keep it as a souvenir. It's been reported that no physical evidence linked Melton to the crime, as none of the hair or fiber evidence or fingerprints that were collected wound up matching him. But of course, much like with Eric Coy's case, no one would have been thinking about DNA evidence back in 1987, so I'd be curious to know if the killer may have left some trace of their DNA on Jeremy's body. Unfortunately, since the authorities may be sticking to the narrative that Sean Melton was the perpetrator, I'm not sure if anyone is still working on the case, but I would like to see someone give it a second look, and perhaps test any physical evidence they might have. Like I said earlier, I am inclined to believe that these crimes are not connected, and that Eric and Jeremy were not killed by the same person. But if they were, it's terrifying to think that this child killer has managed to get away with it for 36 years, and these boys have never received justice. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Eric Coy, please contact the Martinez Police Department at 925-372-3440. That's 925-372-3440. And if you have any new information about the murder of Jeremy Stoner, please contact the Vallejo Police Department at 707-648-4321. That's 707-648-4321. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Hope Grimsley for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released an episode about the unsolved 2012 kidnapping of Violet Ripken, the mother of famous Baltimore Orioles baseball player Cal Ripken Jr., who was abducted from her home by an unidentified man who inexplicably held her in captivity for 23 hours before returning her unharmed. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the unexplained 1984 death of Kurt McFall. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. Another reminder that later this year, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. We've got a specialized promo code which you can use in order to get a 15% discount on tickets to the event, so if you would like to purchase tickets, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use our promo code TRAIL. Once again, in order to get a 15% discount, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com and the promo code is TRAIL. I just want to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.